There's a million different ways to make a painting or write a song. You can wait for the muse to strike while you are in bed or driving. You could come up with a concept to write a poem about every part of the body or every bed you've slept in. Or you could start with a method, a form, maybe a villanelle, maybe something that sounds a little Guthrie, or like the artists on this podcast, you might work with microscopic, intelligent organisms to create your paintings. You might use mathematics to compose your samba.
Hello, everybody.
It's the multicolored cultural laser. We travel the world for the boys and the girls. Casting pots of wonder and amazement. Multicolored cultural laser.
We start today's episode with the visual artist Sarah Roberts, who uses slime molds in her vibrant, fascinating paintings.
I'm Sarah Roberts, and I'm an artist.
I mean, the best way to introduce you to people who don't know you and who don't know you, what you make, is to talk about the idea of what you've been doing with living organisms. You credit slime mold as one of your collaborators.
Well, I like things that are alive. They make me happy. It makes me happy to look at them and think of them. And I like to think that I can have interactions with them, doing what I understand, which is painting, basically. So I understand the world by painting, and I like to try and get other organisms to join in with me, which, surprisingly, most things that move can paint. Don't believe what your art teacher told you at school. You can paint.
Let's talk about the practicalities before we get into like some of the deeper stuff. Because just looking at your piece, like on your wall, say, I can't immediately sense that it has been touched by living organisms. So where would people see that? And how do you control it, or do you not control it at all? Is that part of the pleasure of it?
Okay, well, with the slime mold, what I've been doing is I've been using a technique which was developed by Dr. Simon Park of the University of Surrey. He discovered that you could feed slime mold with fluorescent powder mixed in with its porridge, and it would forage all over the place, and then you could see the traces of where it's been and what it's been doing. So what I do is I make a painting myself with my own traditional paintbrush and ordinary water-based paints. I get the paintings damp, give them a good old bath, and when they're nice and damp, they're an ideal surface for the slime mold, Fusarium polycephalum, to go and forage all over. Having given them their fluorescent powder, their fluorescent breakfast, I let them off sliming all over their paintings, and they seem to quite enjoy it. And what you get is some amazing patterns of their foraging and their decision making. You can actually trace back what kind of state they've been in. Have they been hungry? Have they been a bit sickly?
How can you tell that?
Well, you can look and see. It's a bit like any sort of animal track. You know how you can tell whether a cat's been running fast or slowly by the position of the paw prints. It's kind of similar, but it's all very, very small. For the most part, I think it just looks absolutely beautiful. And what I do is I give everybody an ultraviolet little tiny torch on a chopstick, and they can do their own foraging about the painting to see these traces and trails and tracks.
Do you ever just think, oh man, you guys did a lousy job? It's not your fault. The painting was good when you soaked it. But
absolutely not. No, no. I often think, well, I really wish I was as good as you guys. What I see it as basically, pretty much the same process as a slime mold. I'm investigating the world, and I'm leaving this sort of slightly grubby trail of myself behind that if I come and look at it later, I can understand what was going on a little. You're just constantly responding, and that's what I'm doing. That's what the slime mold's doing.
What was the feeling like when you first soaked your own painting? Did you use like a painting that you're like, oh, maybe I won't use this. If this turns out bad, at least I'm not destroying a piece of artwork that I really like. Was it strange to do, or were you just totally into it from the moment that you were like, yeah, I'm gonna follow this, I'm gonna see how my work works with these kind of molds?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you're going to go off-piste a little bit like that, part of the fun is seeing what happens. So mistakes, terrible calamities. It's all to the good. I was quite pleased that less of my paint floated off my paper than I thought it would, even after weeks of it being cultured. And in fact, you have to keep it moist for the whole duration of the time that the slime mold's there, moist and dark, because that's how they like it. And eventually, your painting begins to go off a little bit, and that's not very nice.
So do you just let the live organisms do whatever they want, or do you try to control them in any way whatsoever, or is it even just by what you feed them beforehand? Or do you try to do anything like that, or do you just see where they go and what they do?
I want them to be as healthy and happy as possible. You can't tell what an acellular organism's idea of happiness is, of course, if you're a human, but you can tell when it is dying, and I'm trying to avoid that. I'm trying to make sure that it keeps as well as possible. So try not to leave it lying around somewhere that it's unhappy. I try to make sure that it's substrate that it sits on and its climate is as nice as possible. And then when it's come off the painting again, I try and give it a nice rest and just give it some nice fresh oak flakes, which it seems to be pretty happy enough. I don't know, it's hard to tell. And then I was having a bit of trouble getting them off the paintings, especially the bigger paintings, because you just get it just kind of swarm its way to the edge, and that'd be brilliant. And then, you know, I could collect it up again on some oak flakes. Occasionally it would just turn around and start foraging all over again, and that's when the paintings would start going off. I found some interesting work that had been done by Professor Adamatsky. He's in Bristol. He does lots of work with slime mould, and he's written lots of fantastic papers, one of which is about how to give your slime mould drugs. And what they really love is valerian root. And it is true, they just seem to go wild for it. The way that they find their food is by smelling it out through chemotaxis, which is a sort of chemical attraction, and they move towards it. And they seem to be able to smell the valerian root from quite a long distance off.
So when you were starting, doing this, were you already interested in the sciences? Because it sounds like the art came before the science. You were painting already before you started moving towards working with these in this biological way. And now you've been working with doctors and collaborating with them as well, and obviously studying and researching. Is that an important aspect of the work, the science of it?
Well, I did a fine art degree millions of years ago, so I suppose the art came before the science in that sense. But to be honest, I don't really like to think of art and science as being very different things. I think they're praxially different, so the practices of doing science and of doing art are different. But actually, what you're doing at the end of the day is, A, you're looking at the world and trying to make sense of it, and B, you're changing, or you're trying to influence the change of one sort of energy into another sort of energy. And that's basically what you do, whether you're an artist, a scientist, or a nurse, or a cleaner. I don't like to have too strong a boundary between the way I think of the world, because it gets in the way. If I think I have to be an artist or I have to do science, then that prevents me from following my curiosity.
Why do you think you were attracted to working with live organisms?
I like to imagine that we're all not only, of course, we're part of the same universe, and of course we're constantly influencing each other, but the boundaries between us are slightly, are a lot more fuzzy than a lot of people would like to think, or conventional narratives would have you believe. Actually getting and to play with other organisms in a sort of way that they can respond to me and I can respond to them seems like a fun way of imagining where those boundaries are fuzzy. I suppose I just want to get to know people, slime molds.
You let people interact with the paintings as well, don't you?
Yeah, I want people to interact with the painting. I want to make my paintings available for people to interact with them. Part of the reason for giving people little torches is so that there's a physical interaction, which they can do as they will. I think looking at a painting is one of the most interactive things that you can do. But because the way that our galleries are set up, we tend to feel that we should be obedient when we're looking at work. And I think that's a terrible thing. I don't think we should be obedient ever if we can help it, unless we really believe that it's a good idea to do whatever it is. Yeah, people having interactions and being aware that they're active players, that they're not just somebody on the end of it and all the creative work's being done by everyone else. They're doing creative work by looking. I'll give you a torch and a light so you can see how it works.
So just so people know, I guess if you've got a chapstick, you've put on a 9-volt battery that I used to put my tongue in, which gives you a beautiful metallic shock. And then you have a UV light attached to the end of it. It looks a little bit like pop-pop gun.
Point it at the
painting. Whoa, okay. And then as you point the UV light at it, all of the little patterns emerge, and it looks kind of looks like the brain. It's part of a picture that's inside. But how do you keep the mold onto? So on this picture, we've got a drawing of a man's head. In the brain region of the cranium, you've got the kind of molds growing in there.
Yeah.
These really beautiful patterns that look very brain-like, yeah?
So I take the little cup that you get a paracetamol in the plastic package, and I cut those out, take the paracetamol out, put the slime mold with the porridge into the cup, put the cup on the painting, and then the slime mold, when it's had enough, it starts to forage over the painting. So it comes out of the cup and onto the painting, and then I can take the cup off again.
And you can control exactly where it's going, so it doesn't go down to his lips.
Oh, no, I can't. No, no, not.
How did it end up just doing it on the brain part? Well, you just used a separate piece?
Might be some more somewhere else.
You're right. They do go. Just really striking from there. Ah. Has your own kind of drawing or painting changed at all since you started working with live organisms? Has it affected the way you actually work?
I've become more careful and more respectful, and I've learned more about how fluid dynamics, I suppose you'd call it.
What's that?
How water moves.
Oh, yes, fluid dynamics.
With gravy in it, water with gravy in it, how it moves, how things that are alive move stuff around. Yes.
Thanks, Sarah. You can find out more about her work by looking her up on the Slime Mold Collective. Ewan McLean is an old friend of the podcast, a musician and mathematician. He composed the music for our very first podcast from the Scottish Poetry Library. And longtime listeners might remember these jaunty sounds playing in the background. Well, he's got a band called Algorithmical, which features some of the best players in Scotland's jazz scene, playing Ewan's own stirring compositions. We sat down to talk about jazz and how Ewan makes his music. The album is out now and available anywhere, and you can find out more about how to get a copy or where to see the band by visiting algorithmical.co.uk.
Ewan McLean, the band's called Algorithmical, and the album's called Impending Joy.
So tell us a little bit about Algorithmical, the band. You've got some amazing players on here. You've got a great concept of where the name came from. Can you just tell us a little bit about what this album is about and how it came together?
So the name, I'm afraid, comes about as because it's a terrible pun. So I spent quite a lot of time in South America, and algo is something in Spanish, and rhythmical, so it's something rhythmical. And also I've worked quite a lot in the area of maths and logic, so I've done some algorithms and some works with algorithms. So it's a terrible pun, and a lot of the titles of the tunes are also terrible puns. It's a theme that runs throughout it, is, you know, not a very good sense of humor. What goes along with that is the music, which is intended to be playful and accessible. And when I say that, I mean, I have on this album, I'm very lucky to have probably my favorite musicians. I have four of my favorite musicians working on it, and they've done some incredible things with my compositions. But I'm not a Paul Harrison or someone like that. Paul Harrison's an incredible Scottish jazz pianist. I'm nothing like that in terms of a musician, but in terms of a composer, I think we've come up with 12 tunes here, which are, I would hope, take away from what I feel is sometimes the alienation to some people of jazz. So when you go to jazz concerts, often I think some people don't understand it. And the reason for that often is because the pure density of the ideas that happen within a few bars and the complexity of the music can be quite alienating to people who are not accustomed to it. And indeed, that was the case for me when I was much younger. I didn't understand jazz at all. And I felt, you know, I used to say things like, this just sounds like a collection of random notes. And now I've progressed into writing collections of random notes myself. What I've tried to do is to structure these pieces in a kind of playful way, but to use some harmonic structures and some more, some inspired from maths and logic that I've worked to try and come up with structures which make some sort of coherent sense, make them more like compositions, so that the improvisation that happens within it is within a context which is not, as I say, I feel sometimes can be alienating to someone who's not used to listening to jazz.
I guess you're talking about that kind of like free jazz kind of thing, what people would associate with free jazz, which is just totally wildly improvisational, which if you're listening to it, it could just sound like dissonant noise, random notes occurring all over the place. Is that what you mean when you talk about like the music people don't think they understand?
Yes, I mean, that's on the far end of it, but I think that even to some extent when you go to gigs and you listen to people experimenting, so when you go and listen to the very best amazing players in Scotland, and you can go and do it for free all over the place, it's incredible. Quite often you'll hear people experimenting and trying stuff out and doing some brilliant stuff, and it's not predictable. And I think that, you know, we all know that when you play gigs, if you play your own tunes, nobody gets up to dance, but as soon as you play Superstition, everybody gets up to dance. And that's because there's a certain notion of predictability and recognisability of music which people like to hear. So I think I'm not just talking about free jazz, I'm also talking about, you know, improvised music in general. My inspiration for the sort of improvised elements of this come from the jazz that I really love, which is people like, I mean, I'm just going to pull names out here, there's millions of them, but, you know, people like Joe Henderson, people like Hank Mobley and Herbie Hancock, who when they play solos, it sounds to me like they're telling a joke or they're telling a funny story, and the band is, you know, joining in with this funny story. And listen to Joe Henderson's solo on Song for My Father by Horace Silver, and it gets more intense as it goes along, and it's a little bit like he's trying to tell you that he's trying to run away from someone or something, and it's a funny and entertaining story that he's telling. And I think that that's, you know, that's a narrative, and what I wanted to try and do was to structure these pieces such that they had some sort of narrative throughout them.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, because actually, you know, listening to, I think the piece we're going to play today, close the podcast, is called River Goeth Over Ethics, and it starts off with a kind of, like, quite sad trombone solo, and then gradually sort of other instruments come in, lighten the mood a little bit, and you have this nice little thing, which I think you called a conversation, where the kind of trombone was there on his own, and then eventually, hey, my friends come around. but I was wondering if that's how conscious you are as you're composing something like that to put that narrative in, or does that something that comes out through improvisation, through playing with these other people, through trying things out?
That's a really good question. So I have a notion in my head of what it's going to sound like, and because these musicians are such that they are, it always comes out sounding better than it did in my head. I actually wrote this piece for Chris Grieve, who's an astonishing trombone player that a lot of people know from Scottish National Jazz Orchestra, from his avant-garde group Newt, which is, you know, really brilliant stuff. What I wanted to write was a kind of beautiful plaintive melody that he was going to play on a trombone. You don't necessarily associate with that instrument with doing that, but this is a musician of such caliber, he's capable of doing that sort of thing, and I wanted to write this for him, so you can figure out the title of the song by thinking about his name. and what I said previously about bad puns. The conversation element actually comes out a little bit from the idiom of Brazilian folk music, which when I lived in Brazil, I listened to a lot of stuff. And you'll hear there some incredible pieces of music played. I heard sort of old choro or sambas as well, where sometimes the lead instrument will be something like a bassoon. And often the instruments kind of join in bit by bit as if they're all coming to join in the song, and it might be started off in this way. So I've tried to do the same sort of thing. And Stu Brown is an absolute expert at that sort of idiom, that Brazilian music idiom. So he's helped to do that. And then, as I say, when the sax comes in, it's a bit more frantic, and his sax has got a bit more of an atonal sort of real quality to what he's playing, and it becomes more of a conversation. So in a sense, I'm trying to tell that sort of story of Chris having this lament and then joining in with the rest of the group to sort of frantically complain about something.
And the thing that struck me was that, and it goes back to kind of some of the stuff you're talking about with alienation and stuff, about the, I guess, the medium of jazz music or instrumental music in general, because I think you do get it with like electronica and stuff like that. People are just like, I don't get it. I know people who would argue that in order to really understand jazz music, you really have to understand where it comes from. You have to know the premises of hard bop and bebop, and then how that leads to what standards people are quoting in the midst of maybe a solo, and how the, because there's also a lot of mathematics just in general in terms of how you perform a solo or perform a piece, and you have to know that. Where I've always argued that you can actually just listen to something. You know, like really simply listen to it, and if you feel something, great, research the artist, research where that sound comes from, what instrument's playing, why they might be playing that way, but you don't actually necessarily need to know the narrative or the story or the history of jazz in order to pick up a record and enjoy it.
No, I completely agree. I think that there's a craft to being a gigging jazz musician which requires a certain on-the-fly understanding of music theory to be able to actually perform in that context. But in terms of listening, in terms of becoming accustomed to jazz, it's just a case of whether you like it or not. I don't think that one needs to be more pretentious about that. You know, if you like the sound of it and you like what you're listening to, and what happens is, as happened to me, is that you become more accustomed to things, your tastes change and develop, and then you know, you become accustomed to the sort of dissonances that you hear in jazz that maybe initially you might have felt were uncomfortable, and then become very, it's a bit like a drug, you know, you start with just a dominant seventh and that's a bit uncomfortable, but you quite like it, and then as you go on you get onto, you know, you get harder dissonances until eventually you just can't cope with major chords anymore, anything diatonic, you just want more and more dissonance. I mean, I think what you say is entirely correct. There's no reason for you to know anything about what's going on. It's just a question of whether you like listening to it or not. And part of my motivation for this album is I hope, at least, that the people that like listening to this, some people who like listening to this, are people that might say, well, I don't normally like jazz, but actually I really like this. And it's a bit like the episode of The Simpsons that I always remember, where Bleeding Gums Murphy, I think, has died, and Lisa campaigns to have his tune played on the local radio, and everyone throughout has been going, oh, I hate jazz, rubbish, and then she plays it, and then everyone calms down and listens on their radio and starts tapping their feet and really enjoying the jazz. And I kind of just remove all the preconceptions that were there beforehand. I really enjoyed that.
This is River Gopher Ethics. We'll be right back.